Well, a plunge now into the history and joys of swimming and why humans swim. Our guest is a swimmer and swim coach, Howard Means. His new book, Splash, celebrates 10,000 years some of swimming. From man's first recorded dip, I don't know if we know it was a man or a woman, to the Olympic Games, Howard explores what it means for us to move through water, sometimes at great speed, more often to cool off, just to look good or just to float around. Touching on changes in fashion and social attitudes along the way. Howard Means is with us from Virginia. Welcome. Great to talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So straight off, why do humans swim?
Boy, to get somewhere. Historically, for military advantage, it was a line of definition between successful and unsuccessful armies in the Mediterranean, navies in the Mediterranean, and I think just for the sheer sensual joy of it. How can you not swim? How can a hot day, how can you not dive into any of the seas around New Zealand or dive into anywhere? It's hard to avoid.
The difference between being in the water, though, to cool off, say, or to gather food or to get to A to B, it's become something else, hasn't it, with the act and the development of how we swim. Are we biologically well designed for it?
We're certainly not as well designed as other mammals who have taken to the water. But swimming there's a whole banquet of things that happen when you go into the water. Good things for your heart, good things for your brain, good things for your body. We're designed. I think in a sense we miss our connection to the water. We're 70% water ourselves, you know, so in a way we're sort of returning to our medium. And also we're aquatic mammals until the moment we're born. So I think there's this sort of desire to get back in the water that sort of traces back to primitive biology.
When did we develop the main strokes we now think of? And I know they've changed even in the last, century or so, but the four Olympic strokes anyway, when did they and how did they come to be mainstream, forgive the pun?
It's a wonderful question because if you look back at the history in Greece and Rome and ancient Greece and Rome, they were swimming what we think of as the crawl today. And that whole sort of knowledge in Europe, at least, absolutely disappears with the fall of Rome. Nobody goes back into the water. Nobody's too strong a statement, but almost nobody goes back into the water. And when Europeans, as the Renaissance emerges, start to think about going back into the water, and they're terrified of it. When they think about doing it, the memory, the sort of genetic and cultural memory of the crawl, the freestyle, whatever you want to call it, has disappeared. And yet it has not disappeared in Africa. It has not disappeared in Micronesia. It's not disappeared in other places, among Native Americans too. It's the natural way to propel yourself at speed forward. It's just that everybody has forgotten in Europe. And that's what really fascinated me when I got into this thing. How could an entire human activity in the most efficient way disappear for 1,000 years?
How do you answer it?
I don't have a ready answer except that. I mean, I answer in the book that fear drove people. The fall of Rome ruined the infrastructure that made rivers and that created pools, which existed in Rome. And it made, without infrastructure, the rivers became polluted, the plague came in, the Black Death, et cetera. Water sort of accreted this kind of spirit world. If you dove in, you're going to get grabbed by something and pulled down to the bottom. Then the Puritans came along, and they made the ability to swim a test of witchcraft. And so all that sort of stuff accreted to it at some point.
What is the earliest record of humans swimming in an organized way, as I said, perhaps not just being in the water for a paddle to collect something or to cool off, but actually swimming? What is our early evidence of it?
There's plenty of early evidence of it. For example, the Greeks trained for swimming because of military purposes. The Romans trained for swimming, and there's plenty of evidence, sort of in the space between ancient Greece and ancient Rome, of people simply swimming collectively for pleasure. There's a beautiful, beautiful inside of a tomb called the Tomb of the Diver, known as the Tomb of the Diver in Paestum, I think it's pronounced Paestum, in southern Italy, that has the dead person who's being portrayed in the inside of the tomb, sarcophagus, is just diving into the Mediterranean with sheer joy in his face. And so there's this sort of the sheer joy of water, combined with the military purposes. The Romans and the Greeks were big on athletic exercise, and so that became part of it, along with the military uses.
The very earliest, though, we always go back to our cave drawings, don't we? Was it in Egypt that we find perhaps the first pictorial or,
Yes, certainly the earliest one we've ever seen, from about 8,000 years ago. In what's been now dubbed the Cave of the Swimmers, these wonderful little pictographs of swimmers all along the cave wall. And anybody who saw the English Patient, it begins with Catherine drawing these things on the wall. And so this is from 8,000 years ago. Why are they there? Particularly, why are they there? And this is the great mystery of it, because the Wadi Sura, where these caves are found, is now, by the aridity index, the driest spot on Earth. It has a drop of water falling on Wadi Sura has the least chance of surviving of any drop of water that falls anywhere on the Earth, including Australia and all sorts of other places with pure desert conditions. So that's where the book began, in a way. I just said, okay, so I got, why? And then you start pulling strings, and you find the Africa human period, and you find that the Earth tilted on its axis. And for about 3,000 years, the Sahara was a humid, it's called the humid period in Africa, was a very swimmable place. There were lots of bodies of water, still water and running water. And they were inhabited by lots of dangerous animals, hippopotamuses, crocodiles, Nile perch, which go to 600 pounds, and you don't want to mess with in the water. So I just kept pulling strings through this whole book, and every time I pulled one, something like that came up.
We mentioned earlier how are we biologically designed. We go all back to our earliest evolution, really. I was joking earlier about crawling out of the primordial ooze, but if we go all the way back, there is a clear sort of biological link, evolutionary speaking. And does that appear in our physiology at all?
I think it still does. And it appears in transitional animal forms getting to us. But in terms of there's something called the mammalian diving reflex, for example, which is how baby seals and baby whales and everything survive. They breathe air, but when they go down, their throat closes up so they can't absorb, they get water under their lungs. Infants, human infants, until 6 months have this same capacity, this mammalian diving reflex. And that's why, and I don't know if they have them in New Zealand, I know in YMCA's here, they have all these water baby courses. You take a kid, you put them underwater, an infant at 3 months old, they're not going to absorb, they're not going to take in water because their glottis closes up and they can't get water in. That is a primitive response that goes back to our earliest days as mammalian, as aquatic mammals.
You mentioned earlier there was this lost 1,000 years. Just before that is what you've dubbed swimming's golden age. Was this when we saw great Roman baths and a cultural reverence for swimming and for organized swimming?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, and that was inherited from the Greeks. I mean, Plato once said that a man is not educated until he can read, write, and swim. And the Greeks sort of felt the same way. The Romans felt the same way. These are Mediterranean people. They're surrounded by water, and it's an essential part. But the Greeks swam. The Romans were engineers, and so they created pools and baths and things like that because they contained water. And everybody got used to this contained water, and then came and you see it in England and at the baths, the great baths at Bath, and you see it at Pompeii and the ruins of Pompeii. When you walk around the ruins of Pompeii, it was water world. If you just look at it in the right way, it was water world. There was water everywhere, and the genius of Rome was to move water from place to place through aqueducts. And so the ruins of Pompeii, and it's really moving to see them, the ruins of Pompeii are a testament to the central role of water in the lives of these people. And the fact that this disappeared for 1,000 years is to me still one of the great mysteries. But I think I try to explain it in the book. I think I do successfully.
So what then brings a swimming 2.0, as you dub it?
Yes. Oh, well. So there are a series of authors. A guy named Edward Digby is the first one in the late 16th century. I'm sorry. Yeah, I always have trouble with these things. In about 1567, who comes up with this sort of guide to swimming. And it's wonderfully illustrated. There are all sorts of 40 woodcuts in the thing, and it's all sorts of explanations. But what you're struck by, what I was struck by when I first looked at it, is most of the explanations are about how to get in the water. People are terrified of even entering the water. And there are lots of instructions about, don't go in, for example, a farm pond in which slaughtering has just taken place. Now, you think that would be kind of common sense, but people had no sense, no understanding of how to enter the water. And so he sort of gets over that hump. And there are 50 books written after that. But the guy who really reads Digby and his Thevenot, who's the French guy who sort of steals his book, is Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin, when he's in London in the 1720s, becomes really the sort of godfather of swimming in England. And then he's followed by Byron. Lord Byron, basically popularizes it because Byron popularized everything. So it sort of works its way into the mainstream slowly. And when everybody starts finally swimming again in England, they've forgotten completely about the crawl. So they take the frog as their model. And gentlemen start, tying frogs up to the spigot of their tubs, filling the tub up and watching the frog and then mimicking its movement as it goes along. Because they have sort of little arms like our arms and big legs, bigger than our legs.
So this is how breaststroke is invented.
This is how breaststroke is invented. and it becomes the European stroke, especially the English stroke. And it serves multiple purposes. And maybe the main one, apart from simply that's all they knew how to do, was that they're swimming in polluted waters. I mean, the Thames is polluted. Everything's polluted. So when you're swimming in rivers, you're swimming in very polluted waters. And all the most famous guidebooks from the 19th century always tell you to have your head 4 inches out of the water. Just to avoid taking sewage in. If you try swimming breaststroke with your head 4 inches out of the water, it's really hard. You can't go so far. You only go so far.
A good stroke without goggles as well, if you forget your goggles. Backstroke is interesting because, of course, if you don't have a ceiling above you, you're forever checking where you're going. But how did it emerge in this history?
Oh, what, goggles?
No, backstroke. Backstroke as a stroke.
Backstroke. Oh, backstroke's a wonderful story. There's a Frenchman shows up in England and challenges some people in a club in London to a race. And he has made this fabulous new stroke called backstroke. Oh, people have been doing sort of inverted backstroke, what we think of as elementary backstroke today. You just lie over on your back and do the same you do in breaststroke. But backstroke, this Frenchman had, he put some money down and they had a famous race and there was lots of press coverage. And the Englishman doing the elementary backstroke and the Serpentine slaughtered him. So it was declared a non-stroke. It would never be a competitive stroke, but it's a natural thing to have. You just roll over and do the crawl backwards. So it's not a complicated thing to have come up with. But the sort of evolution of strokes is fascinating, actually. Meanwhile, crawl has, you know, has survived. And I say Native Americans and other people are doing it. And a couple of American, Native Americans, Ojibways, are brought to London as they were in those days in the late 1840s as sort of museum specimens. So people can judge, you know, can poke them and look at them and things like that. And somebody asked them to take part in a race at a pool in London. And they just slaughter the competition doing what we think of as crawl. And everybody's very impressed. And then they declare it a very un-European, un-English stroke, and it will never take hold. And nobody does it again for about 20 years because it's you know, it's native. It's not proper.
Goodness. It's like swim snobbery, isn't it? Butterfly yes. mystifies people. It's a wonderful stroke to master, and it's a heck of a job getting to the point of mastering it because it's so coordinated in a particular way. Who right. came up with that particular torture of new learners?
I'm sorry, what?
Who came up with butterfly?
Butterfly is a complicated story. There are three or four people who make a claim to it. The guy who actually can claim the dolphin kick, which is boom, 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 kick, that's pretty well established. He was a physicist in Chicago who was studying the way that mammals propel themselves in water. He noticed that fish always go left to right with their tails. I mean, mammals go up and down with their tails. So he had the idea, well, if we're a mammal and we're in the water, why don't we go up and down with the dolphin king sort of side to side, the kind of a whip kick in that way. And then four or five people attach the stroke to it. This is an interesting story because butterfly, we think of it as one of the four strokes. Butterfly did not enter the Olympics until 60 years ago now. It wasn't a recognized stroke. And so a lot of those of us who are swimmers and think about these things, there was no four-stroke individual medley. There was no four-stroke medley relay until roughly about 1956, 1960. Mm-hmm. Before that, butterfly was an acceptable alternative to the breaststroke, as long as you did the breaststroke kick with the butterfly, you know, the overarm butterfly thing.
Oh, that wouldn't work, would it?
No, it works. It works. And they're great. They're great film footage of the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. And an American goes out and he's doing the butterfly, you know, the top and the breaststroke and the back. And he gets 100 yards into a 200-yard race and he practically dies. Two breaststroking a German and a breaststroking Japanese go flying by him, and that's the end of the race. So it wasn't really until 1956, if I remember correctly, that the first butterfly, the pure butterfly as you know today, was introduced. Oh, but it's so much fun to do when you get the rhythm of
it. It's a wonderful stroke. It out of you. The competition side of this, how far back does it go? It's one of the world's great Olympic sports, clearly great sports. And yes. individual sports. And how far back did we get evidence of people seriously competing for speed or for distance? When did it become a sport?
The Japanese, before the birth of Christ, were paid races. They were winning races and getting money for them. But if you go, I mean, in the Western world, it was in Western world, the first evidence of a paid race, purse racing became very popular in England. I mean, you know, the English bet on everything. I don't know about New Zealanders, Kiwis, but New Zealanders, I mean, the English bet on everything. And the first account in the London newspapers of a purse race was about 1796. And there was the equivalent of about 1,200 pounds in the line. I forget what it was in guineas. And it was notable because the guy who won it took his purse and drank himself to death that night. But that began a sort of pattern of purse races. And really, that's what introduced competitive swimming into England and into Europe, basically, were these purse races time and time and time again. It wasn't until the start of the 20th century when purse racing disappeared.
We could go.
I was
going to say, Howard, we could go on forever. I must admit, I have to let you go. We haven't even got into costumes yet, and goodness, we went from being decked from head to toe to Speedos, which was quite a journey in itself. But just as a coach and a person who passionately loves swimming, I can hear in your voice, do we have the ultimate swimming physique? We can all think of what we think of as those freaks of nature, your Michael Phelps and your Ian Thorpes. If you're looking for speed, I guess, what are you looking for? What's the sort of
you're
ultimate physique?
For wingspan, you're looking for speed. More and more, you're looking for lung capacity because the rules were changed about 20 years ago, and now you can go underwater for, let's say, in a 100-meter race. If you're in a long course, 50-meter pool, you can do 40% of the race underwater, because there's less resistance underwater. So the more lung capacity you have, the longer you can spend underwater and the less energy you'll expend doing that. So that's one of the things I had so much trouble with this book was trying to compare times and performance, because swimming is in constant evolution, unlike really any other sport that I know of. The rules are changing, costumes are changing, space age fabrics come in. And then you have this thing where people start doing, you know, underwater for almost a half of the race.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? The tumble turn, just very quickly, the tumble turn was another moment in time too. Who came up with that?
I'm sorry, give me that again.
The tumble turn.
Oh, the tumble turn. Oh, yes, the tumble turn. I'm sorry. I think it was the flip turn around here. I don't know the answer to that. But it was a huge difference. A guy named George Breen I talked to, who won this, who had the world record in the 1650, the mile swim, told me that in 1958, when he won the national championships in the U.S., he did one tumble turn of his 59 turns, and he was criticized for being a hot dog. But now, of course... I don't know if you swim and I do, and you see kids there and you do an open turn and they think, my God, what was that? They have no idea what that was.
Wonderful, so that Howard. Wonderful. And we should get back, Justin. We can't wait to get back to, just as you say, the sheer joy of getting in and swimming however you do it, being in the water, being around others in the water again. It'll be a great joy this summer here, we hope. Thanks very much, Howard Means, on his book, 10,000 Years of Swimming. It's called Splash.